Chapter 4. While we were waiting for the necessary arrangements to be made, Dr. Menick stole over to my console and bent down to whisper in my ear. His voice was a rustle of ghost-stirred leaves. "I cannot impress on you strongly enough the mistake you will be making if you let that thing aboard. You must reason with Campion."
"Reason with him yourself."
"He will not listen to me. He knows what I am, a disavower. I am expected not to approve of the robot, but you are different. If you raise an objection, he will give it due consideration."
"And if I don't have an objection?"
"You must!" The avatar hiss rustled. "Let that thing aboard, and no good will come of it."
"He's not a thing. He's an envoy of the machine people, lost and a long way from home."
"It may well be a trick of Ateshka's. Just some robot weapon he's trying to smuggle aboard your ship so he can hijack it and claim it back."
"Do make your mind up, Doctor. Are you against Hesperus because of your disavower principles, or because you think he's not really a machine person at all?"
"I am against it on as many counts as I can think of."
"The machine people are more civilized than most human societies. Hesperus will just be another guest."
"A wind-up toy that walks and talks."
The avatar's harlequin face creased into an expression of abject disgust.
"Haunted clockwork."
"You won't have to associate with him if you don't want to. And if it really bothers you, you can always go into abeyance until the voyage is over."
"The automatic assumption being that I should be the one to go into abeyance and not the robot. Nice to know where I stand in the pecking order at last, relegated by a box full of mindless algorithms."
"Dr. Menick," I said, as forcibly as I could manage. "Hesperus is coming aboard. That's final. As shatterlings of Gentian line, we could not possibly refuse to assist him."
"It will not see me. You will tell it nothing of my origins, nothing of my physical existence, nothing of my beliefs."
"Then I suggest you keep a very low profile," I said. "If Hesperus catches one of your avatars wandering around, he's likely to wonder who's operating it, isn't he?"
"You will tell it only that I am a scholar. It does not need to know any more than that, and I will not have it anywhere near my tank."
"Why would he have the slightest interest in your tank?"
"Because," the avatar said, "when it learns who I am, as I am sure it will kill me."
I pushed my hand into the open slot of the maker and closed my fingers around the sculpted handle of the energy pistol. The newly minted weapon had the peculiar heft of something crammed with intricate machinery at abnormal densities. Levators allowed me to hold it, but it still had the mass of a small boulder. The adepts who made use of these weapons normally donned power armor to overcome that residual inertia, but I did not wish to greet my guests looking like another robot. I kept telling myself not to be so nervous, but as soon as I chased one fear away, another circled into place. No machine person had ever harmed a human being, so the weapon might have been regarded as both superfluous and insulting. But I was about to release a prisoner who not only possessed superhuman speed and strength, but who might have been rendered half deranged by the time he had spent in Ateshka's care. I just hoped that the weapon would leave more than a dent on that golden armor, if it came to that.
"We're sure about this?" Campion asked.
"No," I said, "not remotely. But I think we've still got to do it." I palmed the control, then stepped back briskly from the upright chassis of his cage. The restraining field loosened its hold on him gradually, so that Hesperus lowered to the ground in dreamlike slow motion. His feet contacted the decking and his arms descended to his sides. He remained standing, but for several moments there was no indication that he was actually alive, rather than just balancing in that position. Then his golden face, averted until that moment, lifted to look me in the eyes. Hesperus was a gorgeous machine. He resembled a man in a suit of close-fitting armor, though he was too slender for a man to have fitted inside that skin. His skull was all elegant planes and gleaming curves. The machine person was both coldly robotic and searingly human, like an exaggerated and stylized caricature of some stunningly handsome man from the fables of antiquity, rendered in gold and chrome. His eyes were densely faceted mechanisms, shifting from opal to turquoise depending on the precise elevation of his gaze. He had a broad, cleft chin. His cheekbones were parallel flanges of chrome, pushing through his skin as if to serve as cooling elements. He had a nose, which appeared to serve no other function than to complement the proportions of his face. His mouth was thick-lipped, the golden lips parted to a narrow slot, with the chromed complexities of his speech-generating systems lurking behind. His skull was gold, save for two coloured glass panels on either side, just above the streamlined representations of his ears. The panels were fretted with a fine webwork of chrome. Behind the facets whirled traceries of pastel light. The rest of him was no less beautiful. There was almost no part of him that was not aesthetically balanced with the whole. He had a sculpted chest plate, a lean chrome abdomen, thin hips and long muscular limbs. The only oddity about him, the only thing that did not look quite in balance, was his left arm. It was thicker below the elbow than his right, and his left hand was heavier, as if he wore a metal gauntlet over the gauntlet of his own hand. It was the only part of him that jarred. Everything else was harmonious. Machine people manifest as men and women, sometimes as children, and occasionally as sexless, luminously metallic beings. Hesperus's face and build left me in no doubt that he had chosen to manifest as a man. He even had a suggestion of genitals, moulded in tasteful gold relief. But there was nothing crass or threatening about his appearance. Hesperus was exquisite, a thing to be admired and coveted. But he was also alive, also powerful and quick and, potentially, the most lethal and clever thing that had ever walked on dalliance. "Who are you?" he asked, his lips moving, even though his face had appeared to be a stiff golden mask until that moment. His voice was a trilling liquid susurration of birdsong, orchestrated into human speech sounds. It was the loveliest thing I had ever heard. "I am Perslane, a shatterling of Gentian line, part of the commonality," I indicated my companion. "This is Campion, a co-shatterling of the same line. You're aboard his ship now. You were being kept prisoner by an entity calling itself Ateshka. I have just negotiated your release." "Do you fear me, shatterlings?" "Perhaps," I said. "You have no cause to. I would put that weapon away if I were you. My intelligence is distributed throughout my body, so it would take more than one shot to kill me. You could hurt me eventually, but not before redirected energies had done a considerable amount of damage to your surroundings." He looked around slowly, his neck pivoting with the eerie smoothness of a gun turret. Shifting effortlessly to trans, he said, "Would it help matters if I spoke the language of the commonality? I do not think it will pose me any insurmountable difficulties." We Gentians like to think that no one else understood trans quite as well as we did. Yet with one sentence, Hesperus had demolished all my certainties. "He's good," Campion whispered. "He's very good." "You speak trans very well," I said. "For a machine." "For anyone not born to it, please. No offense was intended." He regarded me with those glinting opal eyes. He tilted his head microscopically and they flared turquoise light. "Nor was any taken, shatterling. Would you be so kind as to explain my predicament? You have mentioned someone called Ateshka, and the name means something to me, but I am still at a loss to understand how I came here." "Then you don't remember being caught?" "I remember details, but not the whole. I recall that I was traveling." He turned a palm to his chest, fingers stiffened. "Unfortunately, something happened to my ship. A technical fault." "I can probably guess the rest. You dug into your vessel's trove and learned of the existence of a dealer in ships located in this system. Ateshka lured you in, and then decided he would make more credits by stealing your ship than by taking your money. Is that what happened to you?" "Ateshka didn't realize he'd netted a pair of Gentians. We explained to him that if he didn't let us go, he could expect retaliation from the rest of the line." "A formidable threat," Hesperus said. "How did you persuade him to let me go?" "He had no choice once we were free. He'd have been in even hotter water if it became known that he was imprisoning a machine person." "In which case I owe you my gratitude. I am still sorry that you felt the need to bring a weapon. I was worried that you might be disorientated. Then your concern was understandable. My memory is damaged. Might I inquire as to the present date? 6:03:3:485, Crab Standard Time. You're in the Scutum Crook's arm in the Nalumbium system. I was Arteshka's prisoner for a considerable number of years. The last clear date I recall, in the human system, began with a 5. I glanced at the cage. He was still standing inside it, albeit free to walk out. Did Arteshka do something to your memory? The errors I am experiencing are symptomatic of crude electromagnetic interference. He must have been trying to force amnesia on me, so that he could let me go without fear of the consequences. He looked down at his arm, the one that was larger than the other, and then back at me. I am sorry, Shatterlings. It must be quite unsettling to find me like this. Might I ask what you intend to do with me, now that I am in your care? Our next stop, once we've left Arteshka, will be our reunion system. If it's anything like the last couple of get-togethers, there'll be other machine people along as guests. If you wish, we'll take you to them. Otherwise, you can stay aboard our ship as long as you like. I paused, mindful of the delicate matter I was about to broach. Of course, if you were to consent to visit the reunion, it would not hurt my standing in the line. Something can probably be arranged. Have we already left Arteshka behind? There's still a little business we have to conclude before we leave. I offered a hand, inviting him to step forward. You don't have to stay in that thing if you don't want to. He formed a smile. There was something stiffly theatrical about it, the mask too perfectly symmetrical to show human emotions with complete authenticity. But it was still a smile. Thank you, Shatterling. Call me Purslane. Very well, Purslane. He took a cautious step out of the cage, as if expecting the containment field to snap on again. He stretched his arms, turning to the left and the right as if to admire them. I thought of two things, the hunting cat I had once owned in Palatial, and the replica of Michelangelo's David which stood in one of the great hallways of the old household. It is good to move again, Purslane. I cannot express how unpleasant it has been to be Arteshka's prisoner. If I were inclined to revenge... He trailed off. Are you, Hesperus? Campion asked. No, he answered. Revenge is for biologicals. We do things differently.
Dr. Menninx said nothing when he was introduced to Hesperus, but there was a world of calculating suspicion in his paper face.
Arteshka and I were just discussing the other ships, I said. Weren't we, Arteshka?
But you have seen all my ships, the Imago answered.
Hesperus moved into the Imago's line of sight and said, I know what you did to my memory, Arteshka. You were sensible to wipe what you did.
I could have killed you, Arteshka said.
That will be taken into consideration when I return to my people and explain where I have been. In the meantime, in the interests of ameliorating your situation, I suggest that you do everything in your power to comply with the Shatterling's requests. If she wishes to see more ships, show them to her.
Arteshka said nothing. His ship slammed out of the atmosphere, carving a pillar of vacuum in its wake.
Where's he gone? Campion asked. Orbit, I said.
There were no ships in orbit, Dr. Menninx said. We should have seen them, even if they had the benefit of camouflaging screens. Nothing is that invisible.
We did see them, I said. We just didn't see them.
Campion settled into his couch and tugged his hovering console down until it was within easy reach. He punched commands and took dalliance up and out. By the time we had cleared the atmosphere, Silver Wings was racing to meet us. We were above the equatorial plain of the Jovian, looking down on a sunlit face.
I do not understand, Dr. Menninx said.
Me neither, said Campion, staring at the planet. All I'm seeing is...
The ring system, I finished for him.
Show them, Arteshka. Campion and the Doctor are having one of their slow days.
Show us what? Campion asked. That was when the wave of change began spreading through the rings. Something awesome was happening down there. The very texture and brightness of the rings was transmuting, beginning in a perfectly straight line that then swept slowly around, moving with the eerie steadiness of a clock hand. Where the line had passed, the rings were darker and somehow more tenuous in appearance. Where before they had cut through the face of the planet like swathes of silver-white ribbon, now they resembled ribbons of smoke. "That's where he hid them," I said. "Most of the particles are still chips of water ice, but the ships are much bigger. He tuned their impassors so that the bubbles had the same reflectivity as the rest of the particles. Now he's turning them off, so there's not so much light being thrown back at us." I had seen larger constructs. We all had. But beyond a certain scale, vast was simply vast, whether it was the hovering majesty of the Jade Cathedral on Lutetium, a second Imperium moonship, or the light-year-long bones of the Prior machinery near Sagittarius A. There was room in those rings for a lot of ships. "How many?" I asked, hardly daring to.
60,000, give or take," Ateshka said. "I've been collecting for a very long time."
"Take your pick," I told Campion. "If you can't find the ship you're looking for here, you may as well give up. I bet he's got at least one of everything."
"I'm not sure now," Campion said with an abashed smile.
"Not sure about what?"
"That I actually want to get rid of Dalliance. So what if she's made me late for a few appointments? It's not as if she didn't get me there in the end in one piece."
"You have an excellent point, honored Shatterling," said Ateshka. "Why dispose of something when it has served you well? Of course, once you have specified your requirements, it will still take a little while to complete the refurbishment. The components must be sourced and integrated into your ship. I believe we are looking at months, if not years, of work. Do you wish to enter abeyance until matters are completed?"
"Nice try," I said. "I have a nagging feeling we'd never wake up if we put ourselves asleep."
"We'll just have to take turns," Campion said.
"That may not be necessary," said Hesperus in his beautiful trill of a voice. "I have no need of abeyance, as you understand it. I am willing to supervise matters while the two of you sleep. I believe I can hold Ateshka to his guarantees."
Campion and I looked at each other. I suppose we were both thinking the same thing. We had no evidence that Hesperus was an authentic envoy of the machine people. Given Ateshka's demonstrated treachery, Hesperus might very well be a plant, a last-ditch stratagem for regaining control of us.
"You can trust me," he said, as if reading our thoughts, "now and forever."
"We can't be certain of this creature's intentions," Dr. Menix said.
Angrily I turned on the paper harlequin. "Are you volunteering to stay awake in that case?"
"That is not what I meant."
"I do not blame any of you for harboring suspicions," Hesperus said. "I also have suspicions. Do you really intend to return me to my people, or are you simply lying to gain my compliance? Were you complicit in my imprisonment?"
"We weren't," I said.
Hesperus raised a calming hand. "The point is, these doubts cannot be settled instantly. It will take time. For now, let me prove my trustworthiness by guarding you while Ateshka honors his obligations."
"Could you take care of my ship as well, and make sure Ateshka doesn't cut any corners?" Campion asked.
His eyes gleamed turquoise as he turned to face the Imago.
"Corner cutting will not be an option, I assure you."
Chapter 5 Perslane and Hesperus were facing each other, seated on opposite sides of a low gaming table. Tiny spectral armies stalked a shadowy landscape wreathed in a cloak of mist and gunpowder. The two gamers were commanding their battalions with subtle hand gestures, like expert puppeteers.
"Any sign of Dr. Menix?" I asked, having just whisked up ship from the propulsion chamber.
"Still asleep, or whatever he gets up to in that tank of his," Perslane said.
"That's a shame."
"Isn't it?" Hesperus made a series of complex gestures, breaking his battalion into countless little divisions. Perslane pouted as they overran her forces, swarming amongst her men like rampaging insects. A little flag waved from a smoke-girdled summit.
I thought of Count Mordax's ghost soldiers, storming the kingdom on their pale, bony horses.
"Looks like he's beaten you again," I said.
"He always does," Perslane said, leaning away from the table. I asked him to play down to my level, but he won't.
"I would rather defeat you than insult you," Hesperus said. "Besides, the game is good practice for my memory. I have improved my short-term faculties since we last spoke, Campion."
"That's good." Perslane rose and stroked a finger against the side of my cheek. "That's enough fun and games for me, anyway. You and I have work to do."
"The strands," I said, with as little enthusiasm as I could muster.
"We can't put it off much longer. I really ought to whisk back to Silverwings and start work on my side of the story."
Putting it off for as long as possible was exactly what I had hoped to do. We were 2 days out from Ateshka, 202 days after he had bowed to our requests. Thanks to Hesperus, the work had been completed more than satisfactorily. Dalliance was humming along at a whisker below the speed of light.
"I shall not detain you from whatever business you must attend to," Hesperus said. "But might I ask a question, Campion?"
"Go ahead."
"It concerns your guest."
"I've got a lot of guests, thanks to Ateshka."
"I am referring to Dr. Menix."
"I thought you might be. Is there a problem with him?"
"I do not think Dr. Menix cares for my presence on this ship. Is that a fair assessment of his feelings?"
I tried to shrug off his question. I can't say what's going on in his head.
"If I did not know better, I would say that he is a disavower. That is one of the things I do remember. The disavowers do not believe that machines have any right to be considered sentient. In their most extreme manifestation, they would seek to eradicate machine intelligence from the galaxy."
"I don't think Dr. Menix is quite that far down the road."
"Give him time," Perslane murmured. "But he is a disavower?" Hesperus asked.
"I don't think he's really serious about it," I evaded. "The lines don't have much truck with the disavowers. Cromwell wouldn't have brought the doctor to our reunion if he suspected Menix was a paid-up machine-hater.
Given the manner in which he has been delayed, one suspects that Dr. Menix has decided the Gentian policy is no concern of his. Might he now be allowing his mask to slip?"
"The doctor had some misgivings about letting you aboard. They weren't specifically to do with you being a machine person, rather that you were an unknown quantity."
"I see," Hesperus said, as if my answer had told him a great deal more than I had intended.
"Really, it's not that big a deal. You don't have to see each other if you don't want to. It's not as if he poses you any kind of threat."
"That is not my fear. I merely wish to establish cordial relations with your guest, in the hope that talking to him might shed light on some corner of my memory as yet unilluminated. Perslane told me that the doctor is a scholar, on his way to an engagement. That struck a chord with me, as if our trajectories might be similar."
"The doctor was on his way to the Vigilance," I said.
"The Vigilance,"
Hesperus echoed, as if testing the sound of the word.
"I know of this, although I cannot say why. What became of his engagement?"
"Nothing. It wasn't possible to deliver him to them without throwing me off schedule for the reunion." I forced a half smile. "Look on the bright side, though. If I hadn't let down Menix, I'd never have met you."
"And I would still be a prisoner of Ateshka."
"Precisely."
"Then Dr. Menix's misfortune is my great good luck, I suppose. I should like to know more of this Vigilance, Campion. Now that the word has been spoken, it feels like a key to unlocking more of my buried memories. I am even more anxious to discuss my predicament with the doctor."
"I can tell you all about the Vigilance," I said. "I was there. Would you like to see my trove?"
"That would be very kind indeed," Hesperus said.
Seen from outside, as I braked down from interstellar speed, the Vigilance was a hole punched in the pale shimmer of the Milky Way, where it transected the Norma and Cygnus arms. In infrared it was the hottest thing for 1,000 lights, blazing out like a beacon. Visible light photons from the star at the heart of the Vigilance had been downgraded to heat, seeping out in all directions. Somewhere in between,
They had given up much of their energy to the Vigilance's ceaseless information-gathering and archiving activities. The Star was the engine in the basement of the library, a machine for turning hydrogen into data. The Vigilance exists around a solar-type star, with about 1 billion years left on the main sequence, or until a wormhole must be sunk into its core for refueling. Once upon a time, that star almost certainly had a full arsenal of planets, moons, asteroids, and comets, but none now remain. Every useful atom in the system has been reorganized into the component bodies of a Dyson swarm, numbering about 10 billion in total. The Priors knew how to smash worlds and reforge their remains into the unbroken shell of a true Dyson sphere. Humans can do the smashing part, but all efforts to construct a shell of the necessary rigidity have failed. The best we can do is to englobe a star in a swarm of bodies, moving on independent orbits, like flies buzzing around a lantern. At 50 hours from the outer boundary, I transmitted an approach request and identified myself as Gentian. There was no response. I slowed down to system speed and made a further series of approach requests. I was doing everything by the book, following the wise counsel of the Trove. The distance narrowed to a handful of hours. I slowed again, to the point where it would take me a year of flight to cross the remaining distance. Save for brief catnaps, I stayed awake and alert for the entire time, not even allowing myself a dose of synchromesh. Slowly that black sphere enlarged until it was swallowing half my sky, its horizon so flat it felt as if I had reached the wall at the end of the universe. At 3 light seconds, the Vigilance deigned to notice me. It was, technically speaking, an attack. The scalding energies that twinkled against Dalliance were enough to ablate meters of her hull before the impasse rose to full effectiveness. I had not run with the impasse raised, because that would be construed as an approach with hostile intentions. As far as the Vigilance was concerned, this was no more than a polite challenge. They were simply testing my seriousness, determining whether or not I was someone it was worth doing business with. It should have been enough that I had survived the challenge, but the Vigilance saw fit to up its entry criteria several times before I reached the swarm's surface. Escalating energies rained against my shields, stressing them to their limit. Those concentrated defense systems could have destroyed me many times over, were I judged a real threat. I had been toyed with, teased, no more than that. Presently a door opened. The orbits of thousands of the outer bodies had been adjusted so that a dark tunnel formed in the swarm, arrowing deep into its heart. My nervousness peaked. As the door sealed behind me, I was vulnerable to attack from all angles. As I fell deeper, the bodies of the swarm blocked any view of open space. Dalliance reported that the space around us was crackling with information flow. The main beams were being routed around us, but occasionally a photon or two would ricochet off a stray grain of dust into Dalliance's sensors. The spheres were artificial worlds, the largest of them tens of kilometers across, and the smallest not much larger than Dalliance. Each was dark and smooth, their surfaces uninterrupted save for the circular apertures of signaling antennas. According to the Trove, the spheres held concentric levels of processing machinery, wrapped around a fist-sized kernel of quark matter. Levators toiled to keep each node from crumpling in on itself. Data was organized in the layers according to reliability and access frequency. Data of high provenance, or which seldom needed amending, was concentrated in the safe, stable depths of the quark kernels. It was troublesome to read in and out, but immune from accidental change or deletion, and safe against even a local supernova. Suspect or volatile data was kept in the intermediate and outer shells, occasionally shuffling higher or lower as it was reclassified. New data was fed in from the outside under the painstaking supervision of the Vigilance's curators. Very few living souls had ever seen one of those strange, slow creatures. It was presumed that there were at least as many curators as there were bodies in the swarm, but since the curators hardly ever needed to travel either within the swarm or beyond it, their true number could not be ascertained. I had consulted the Troves, but all they had told me was that there were many theories about the curators, and that few of the accounts could be reconciled with each other. The Vigilance thrived on collating information, but by the same token it seemed mischievously keen to spread misinformation about itself. I was thinking about that, wondering what chip of dubious value I would add to the mosaic, when Fields snared Dalliance and brought her to a halt relative to one of the larger bodies in the swarm. We had fallen about halfway into the shell. The light of the star was beginning to bleed through the floor of swarm bodies below me, its yellow-white brilliance diminished to a deep, brooding scarlet. A voice, more ancient than old-growth civilizations, deeper than time, slower than glaciers, boomed across the bridge in trance.
"State the purpose of your visit, Chatelaine."
I had rehearsed my answer countless times. "I have nothing to offer that is worthy of the vigilance. I am here only to open my troves for your inspection, worthless though they are, and to pass on the goodwill and blessings of Gentian line, the House of Flowers."
"Do you wish to access our archives?"
"Yes," I said, for one never lied to the vigilance, "but I do not expect that access to be provided. As I said, I am here on a goodwill basis."
"Please wait," the voice rumbled, sounding like a distant landslide. "Your case is under referral."
I waited. I waited a week, then a month, then half a year, then 6.5 years. All the while Dalliance was pinned in place, going nowhere. I was asleep when the voice boomed again, but I had taken precautions to have myself roused to full consciousness the instant anything happened.
"You will be admitted into the node. No further action is required on your part at present."
One of the circular apertures in the swarm body revealed itself to be an irising door, wide enough for Dalliance to fit through. The Fields cajoled my ship inside, prodded her down a narrowing shaft, then left her floating at the center of a spherical holding bay. According to Dalliance's inertial measurements, far from foolproof, we were still some distance from the center of the swarm body. The walls around us were dimpled with smooth, perfectly round craters, the rims of which glowed arterial red. The Fields had released their hold, but with the door closed behind me, there was nothing to do but wait. So I waited. 11.5 years this time. It may sound as if, to a Chatelaine, accustomed to crossing the galaxy in circuits lasting hundreds of thousands of years, 11 years is nothing. But our minds are not wired that way. Those 11.5 years consumed lifetimes. But at the end of it all, I was joined by another presence. One of the craters irised open, and a vehicle began to intrude into the holding bay. It was bulbous, with a dome-shaped prow connected to an ovoid hull, and various smaller ovoids branching off the hull. It was about 6 times smaller than Dalliance, 700 or 800 meters from end to end. The technology was more primitive-looking than I had been expecting. The brassy brown hull had a corroded look to it in places, mottled and scarred in others, and there were crude mechanical connections running between the ovoid sections suggested of the docking collars on primitive spacecraft. As it cleared the door, the ship began to tilt, turning its long axis through 90 degrees. It did this with great ponderousness, as if it moved to a different, slower physics than Dalliance. Some change occurred to the domed part of the hull, the opaque plating becoming milky and then translucent, as if smoke was clearing from behind a window. Behind the translucence loomed a complicated structure, some kind of leathery, biologically derived machinery. The machinery was a face, looking out at me through the glass of a helmet. It was not human, but I could tell that it had been human a long time ago. It was as if a face had been carved in a cliff and then subjected to eons of weather, until the features were no more than residual traces. The eyes alone were 10 meters across, the face 10 times as wide. The mouth was a dark and immobile crevasse in the granite texture of the creature's grey-tinged flesh. The nose, the ears, were no more than worn-away mounds on the side of a hill. The head swelled at the neck and vanished into a huge body concealed by the connecting ring around the base of the domed helmet. The eyes blinked. It was less a blink than the playing out of an astronomical event,
like the eclipse of a short-period binary. It took minutes for the lids to close, minutes again for them to ooze open. The eyes were looking at me, but there was no focus in them, no hint of animation. The figure drifted closer. From one side of the hull, a string of jointed ovoids became a grasping arm with fingers at the end. The fingers were as large as trees. They closed around dalliance, and I felt their tips clang against the hull. The ship, sensing my mood, was wise enough not to take retaliatory action. It turned out that the curator was only interested in touch. Over the course of several hours, he ran his hand along dalliance, cupping and stroking her, as if he needed reassurance that she was not a phantasm. Then he slowly pulled back. The voice, which I had not heard for more than 11 years, boomed again. It was as if no time at all had passed for the curator.
"There is just the one of you, Shatterling. You have come alone."
"It's the way we travel, except when we have guests. Thank you for letting me come this far." The giant being's face registered no change when I was being spoken to, but I had no doubt that I was being addressed by the curator. Whatever functions that mouth served, the creation of language was not one of them. The creature floated where it was, perfectly still save for the occasional blink of those monstrous pond-like eyes. It blinked about once an hour.
"You have been very patient, Shatterling."
"I was told that patience would be necessary, curator." Aware of how easily the vigilance could be angered, I felt as if each word I uttered was a grenade about to be thrown back in my face. "Is that the right term of address?" I asked.
"For you," the curator answered, "do you have a name other than Gentian Shatterling?"
"I am Campion," I told it.
"Tell me about yourself, Campion."
I gave it my potted life story. I was born 6 million years ago, one of 1,000 male and female clones of Abigail Gentian. My earliest memories are of being a little girl in a huge, frightening house. It was the 31st century in the golden hour.
"You have come a long way. You have outlived almost all the sentient beings who have ever existed, including the Priors."
"I've been very, very lucky. Lucky to have been born into Gentian line. Lucky to have been able to live through so much time without experiencing more than a fraction of it."
"To live through deep time would be considered unfortunate."
"I didn't mean that. Rather, that I'm carrying a brain not so very different from the ones humans had when we were still hunter-gatherers. There are some modifications that help me process memories and the strands of my fellow Shatterlings, but Abigail never touched the deep architecture. Our minds just aren't engineered to experience that much time in the raw."
"You would go mad."
"I'd need help."
"You must wonder how we have coped. It is known that curators are very old, very long-lived. Unlike you, unlike the late Rimrunners, we do not have the luxury of time dilation to make the centuries fly past."
"You appear to be managing well enough."
"You would presume to know."
"The mere continued existence of the Vigilance is evidence that you have overcome the difficulties of extreme longevity. No other stellar-based culture has endured as long."
"There would be no point in the Vigilance if it was ephemeral. Our watch is a long and lonely one. We always knew it would require great patience, a willingness to take the long view."
"Are you as old as the Vigilance?"
"That would make me more than 5 million years old, Shatterling."
"I'm nearly 6.
"Except you aren't, really. You were born that long ago, but I doubt you have experienced more than a few tens of thousands of years of subjective time. You are a bookworm who has tunneled through the pages of history. Is that not so?"
"That's an apt analogy, curator."
For me to be as old as the Vigilance, I would need to have endured all those years. That would make me one of the most ancient organisms in the galaxy. For all I know, you may be. I am not the oldest curator, but I am still growing. All of us are. In the dawn of our kind, we found a pathway to biological immortality that depends on continued growth. There are other pathways, but this is the one we settled upon. Are there curators larger than you? Absolutely. You will not see them, though. They inhabit the largest nodes, with the most important kernels. Most of them are too large to leave now. Their heads would fill this chamber. They are beings of awesome wisdom, but they are also very slow. Nothing can be done about that, though. When synaptic signals have to cross distances of hundreds of meters, even the simplest thought may take several minutes to formulate, we find dealing with them taxing. But I'm sure you understand. From your perspective, well, we'll say no more about that, shall we?
I was not really surprised to be dealing with a giant, though it had taken me a moment or two to appreciate the true nature of my host. Many of the accounts in the Trove spoke of the enormous size of the curators, although the details varied too widely to be of much use. When I left the Vigilance, I would add my contribution to that confusing picture. The next visitor might encounter something completely bewilderingly different. "Do you always live in that suit?" I asked.
"Not always. We breathe fluid, not air, although you could not be expected to know that. There are spaces where we may discard our suits and still survive, but it would be much too difficult to equip all the nodes with pressure-filled chambers. Eventually we outgrow our suits, then we must move to one that has recently been discarded by an even older curator. I have been in this suit for more than 100,000 years, and I still have some room for growth. Before me this suit held many other occupants. It must look old to you, but it is constructed very robustly. Many more will wear it after I have moved on. My ship is considered old by the rest of my line, but it works for me."
"That's the important thing, Shatterling.
Would you like to inspect the contents of my trove, Curator? You won't find anything of interest in there, but as a courtesy it's the least I can do."
"Is your trove portable? Clearly I am much too large to fit inside your ship."
"I can bring the trove outside."
"That would be satisfactory. Emerge from your ship when you are ready. Take your time. We don't rush things around here."
Half suspecting I might need one, I had already instructed the Maker to fashion me a suit. It was strange to feel myself encased by the claustrophobic, faintly masochistic contraption. Whisking is a million times easier. The suit did its best to make me comfortable. I slipped through Dalliance's long-forgotten dorsal lock, inspecting the bruise-raw, weapon-scarred hull as I pushed away into the vacuum of the node's holding chamber. Hexagonal repair platelets were already oozing from various points in Dalliance's skin, linking together to form the lacy scaffold of a bright new epidermis. The trove was a faceted purple-black cylinder, clutched in my right hand, with a gold interface collar around its midsection, where it normally plugged into the ship. It felt as if I was dragging a small neutron star around with me. The trove was brimming with data, knowledge, and wisdom.
"Will that suit keep you alive for a long while, Shatterling?"
"Long enough, I hope."
"Then tell your ship to await your return. It can take care of itself while you are absent."
"It's already done."
"Then hold still. I will take care of you."
The curator's hand moved towards me, the fingers splaying wide and then closing slowly, tenderly, around my tiny squashable form. The suit creaked as the fingers took hold, and began to drag me and the trove in the direction of the face. I had not noticed it until then, but there was a nozzle-like aperture in the ring connecting the curator's helmet to the rest of his body. A door opened in the nozzle and I was popped inside,
into a weightless chamber the size of a small cargo hold. The door sealed and briny pink fluid erupted in, boiling at first before it had squeezed the vacuum out of the room. My suit pondered the ambient chemistry. The liquid was a soup, thick with long-chain molecules. A second door opened and I drifted out with the tidal flow of the liquid. I paddled to recover my orientation. I was in the helmet, floating in the liquid space between the curator's chin and the glass. The curator breathed so slowly that it was like the ebb and flow of water at a lazy shoreline. I continued my drift until I was level with the awesome gash of the mouth, stretching away to either side of me, the lips curved like sandstone carved by underground rivers.
"Is this distressing for you, Shatterling? You must tell me if it is distressing."
"I'm fine."
"Not everyone has been as comfortable as you in this situation."
"I don't think you meant to hurt me. You could have done that already."
"I could mean to eat you. Have you considered that possibility?"
"Now that you mention it."
"I don't mean to eat you. Not in the sense we are both imagining. But it is necessary for me to swallow you. You'll see why in a few moments. Be reassured that no harm shall come to you, and that your stay inside me will be temporary."
"Then I shall take your reassurance." The mouth widened by degrees, until there was room for me to pass between the lips. "Curator," I said, as I fell into that bottomless trench, "I hope you don't mind me asking, but what guarantees do you have that I'm not going to do you harm once I'm inside you?"
"Even if you destroyed this entire node, you would barely scratch the sum total of the data in our possession, and nothing valuable would be lost."
"I might have tried."
"You have been examined more thoroughly than you probably realize. We have a good understanding of the capabilities of your ship. It has weapons, but it is not warlike, and your suit contains nothing harmful at all."
"And me?"
"We have looked inside you. We found only meat and bones, and a salting of harmless machines. The trove might be a bomb, of course, but that is a chance we shall take. No act of knowledge acquisition is entirely without risk."
I was being carried down the curator's throat by the flow of swallowed fluid. Ahead of me, picked out in lurid pinks and mauves by the suit's lamps, the spongy door of an epiglottis hinged shut just as I was about to go through it. I was going into the stomach, not the lungs. I rode peristalsis all the way down, the walls of the curator's gullet squeezing and opening to propel the sack of fluid in which I floated. Eventually the narrowing shaft deposited me in a warm, liquid-filled compartment. I guessed that I was somewhere deep in his torso, probably in the lower abdominal region, but I had no idea in which organ or compartment of an organ I had arrived. The curator's internal anatomy might not bear much resemblance to that of a baseline human, even if one allowed for the differences in scale. The peculiarities of the curator's digestive tract became apparent as I took in more of my surroundings. The chamber was more or less hemispherical, with the entry point near the pole of the half-sphere. The walls of the hemisphere were ribbed with stiff, glistening struts, radiating out from the door, some kind of bone or cartilage. The ribs flexed and eased on a very slow cycle, as if the curator's balloon-sized lungs were expanding and contracting somewhere above us, behind meters of abdominal wall and pleural cavity. What was unusual about the chamber, what made me think it had no counterpart in my own body, was the floor, or wall, opposing the domed part. It was a sea of waving, undulating arms, like a grove of anemones. The arms were two or three times longer than me, and they pulsed with hypnotic colors, flickering and strobing as they brushed against each other. Some of the arms were bent back on themselves, their tips vanishing into the luminous mass. I paddled closer and saw dark objects lodged in the gaps between the arms, pressed deep into the fleshy base in which the arms were rooted. The objects were cylinders, cubes and ovoids, and the arms that were bent over were attached to them, fixed by their sucker-like tips to the shells of the boxes or plunging into them via holes or gaps in their casings. I was still carrying the trove. Without being told what to do, I gave it a shove in the direction of the waving arms and let it drift. A dozen or so arms flexed towards it, stretching to their fullest extent and puckering their tips like animals hungry for the teat. The trove fell within reach, and the arms wrestled with it, squabbling over which of them should have possession.
"Welcome to my gut," the curator said. "This is an interface to my nervous system. There are others inside me, but this will suffice for our purposes."
"Those other objects, they're also troves, aren't they?"
"Troves, or things very like troves. In most cases they were donated by their owners. I will not expect the same of you, but I am still curious about the contents of your trove."
One of the arms fastened itself to the middle of the trove, contacting the gold interface ring. The arm shivered with color, vibrant pulses racing from the tip to the fleshy root. "Are you reading it now?"
"The process has begun, Shatterling. It will take a while, but these things must be done properly. The data is not going any further than my head. I am a buffer between your trove and the rest of the Vigilance for now. We have long been wary of data contamination."
While I was distracted, three of the arms had reached out and made contact with my suit. I was being hauled in slyly, as if they did not want me to realize what was happening. I flinched and jerked myself free. "May I ask some questions, Curator?"
"There is never any harm in asking."
But there was, I thought. There was potential harm in the most innocent act of data acquisition, as even the Curator had acknowledged. "There's quite a lot about the Vigilance we don't know."
"Many of your kind have been here already. Did they not satisfy your curiosity?"
"There are still some pieces missing from the picture."
"And you think you will make a difference?"
"It's my duty to try. My duty to the line and the commonality."
"Then far be it from me to stand in the way of your inquiries, Shatterling."
I felt as if I was standing tiptoe on the edge of something treacherous. I had done well so far, if only because I was still breathing. I had been allowed entry into the swarm, into one of the swarm's processing nodes, and I had been given an audience with a curator. Very few envoys had got this far, at least not the ones who ever reported back. "We've long understood that the Vigilance gathers information from across the galaxy, from the entirety of the meta-civilization. On the face of it, this process looks omnivorous. You don't appear to favor one line of investigation over another."
"Such an impression would be understandable."
"But on deeper inspection, we found hints of structured inquiry. Those travelers who have made it in and out of the Vigilance, both intact and insane, have found certain datasets prized over others. You value certain forms of information more than others, at least when your transactions are examined over deep time, across countless examples."
"And the nature of this bias?"
"Andromeda," I said. "Specifically, the absence. Taking the long view, the Vigilance can be seen as having a single all-consuming purpose, even though that purpose is sometimes obscure. You're organized to gather every known snippet of data concerning the disappearance of the Andromeda Galaxy and anything connected with that event."
"Many civilizations are fixated on the absence. It would be difficult for a galactic society not to be."
I dared to shake my head, though I had no idea if the gesture was visible. "Everyone thinks about the absence, that's true. Everyone worries about what it means. But even the commonality hasn't gone much further than that. A few observations, a few theories, but that's it. Mostly we've learned just to get on with life. That might seem blinkered, short-sighted, a kind of denial even. But what else can we do? Whatever's happened to Andromeda, it's bigger than anything in our experience. Even if we understood what had happened, we couldn't begin to do anything to stop it happening here. It's symptomatic of something so far beyond our conception. It might as well be an act of God."
"Perhaps that's exactly what it is."
"God snatches a galaxy out of existence as a warning against human hubris."
"Even if it is the work of God, a hypothesis our data does very little to support, it would be inaccurate to describe the absence in those terms. Andromeda may not be visible anymore, but there is still something there. There are even some stars left over, caught outside the absence when it formed. In truth, it would be better to call it the occlusion."
The names stuck,
I'm afraid. But I thought on what the curator had said, and reminded myself that he was correct. The commonality's own observations concurred. Andromeda had not so much gone as been blacked out. Just as the Vigilance's Dyson Swarm blocked out the light of the Milky Way, so Andromeda continued to mask the glow of the rest of the universe, all the way back to the fierce simmer of the cosmic microwave background. But the thing that was sitting where Andromeda used to be was not precisely a galaxy either. It was more like a squat black toad, a fat blob of darkness with the razor-sharp edge of an event horizon. But it was not a black hole. As the curator had mentioned, there were stars and globular clusters still circling beyond the fringe of the blob, and their orbits were not what one would have expected if they were traveling so close to a black hole's surface, where frame-dragging would have played a role. Those outlying bodies moved as if nothing had changed, as if Andromeda was still there. No one had an inkling as to what the black toad really signified, but one thing was clear, ominously so. Andromeda was a galaxy much like our own. Life could have arisen there, as it had in the Milky Way. It was even possible that life had still been going on there until the moment of the absence. The fear was that what had happened to Andromeda might happen to us if we were not careful. "Some of us think it's a protective measure," I said. "It's the Andromedans building a wall around themselves to keep us out. They've watched us spread through our own galaxy and they don't like what they see."
"A wall is also a prison. Would that not be somewhat self-defeating?"
"It's only a theory. I don't doubt that the Vigilance has better ones."
"Oh, we do. Many, many of them. How could a wall have been constructed so quickly? It would have required synchronized activity on a galactic scale, beyond anything we can conceive of. How could we possibly be a threat to any civilization capable of that degree of coordination?"
"I don't know."
"It is the absence that interests you most, Shatterling. Is that why you came here?"
"I came here to bring the blessings and goodwill of Gentian line. Anything else is a bonus." When the curator spoke again, there was a warning note in his voice.
"You haven't answered my question."
Sweat dappled my brow. "I'm interested in the absence, but only as a key to finding out more about you. Like I said, the commonality prefers not to dwell on the absence. There's no great hunger for new data, new theories, amongst the lines. They don't want to think about it too much. It's like worrying about death, when you can't do anything about it."
"Why are we so fascinating?"
"Because you're old, I suppose. In the lines we speak of turnover. We look down on galactic society and see civilizations cresting and falling like waves. We've grown used to the idea of being the only permanent fixture around here. Then we started paying attention to the Vigilance, and realized that wasn't the case."
"We've been around a long time. It's not as if you've only just noticed our existence."
"No, but for circuits, we had you down as an anomalous curiosity, nothing more. We were wrong, obviously. The Vigilance isn't just a stellar culture that has beaten the odds of extinction. Everything about you points to a society that knew it was going to be around forever and ever, and was going to do all in its power to make that happen. I've seen other Dyson swarms, but nothing approaching the single-minded efficiency of this one. You've been ruthless. You haven't left a pebble unchanged. And you, the curators, you're part of it as well. You've been prepared to alter yourselves beyond all recognition, to take massive steps away from the baseline humans you used to be."
"You've seen stranger things than me."
"I've seen things that ended up strange, like the Rimrunners, but they got that way as a consequence of near-random change across millions of years. They didn't have a plan. I think you knew exactly how you were going to end up from the moment you started. You were going to become huge, slow giants, and you were never going to stop growing. And that's interesting to me, because it implies that the purpose of the Vigilance was set in stone long before the absence happened. It caught everyone else unawares, but, unless I'm wrong, you were waiting for it."
"We were as startled by the absence as anyone. Nothing in our observations had anticipated it."
"You were looking at Andromeda, though.
You may not have been expecting the absence, but you had a reason to keep your eyes on that galaxy.
It is our nearest neighbor of any size, therefore bound to merit attention.
There are other galaxies in the local group, some of which could be considered potentially viable for life. You showed some interest in those, but Andromeda has always been your main focus.
That is indeed a puzzle. Shatterling.
We think that you found evidence of prior activity, stellar engineering, Dyson englobements, that kind of thing. They weren't sending us intentional signals, but they were still giving away their existence. We would have been spacefaring for 2.5 million years before they even knew we existed, so it's entirely possible that they used to think they had the local group to themselves. They'd have arrived too late on the scene to witness the activities of the Milky Way priors, or else they were assumed safely extinct. Either way, our emergence must have been a cause for concern. The commonality thinks that the vigilance was instigated to monitor Andromeda, to keep tabs on the Andromeda priors, and determine whether they were a threat or a blessing. If it took millions of years to make that decision, so be it. You can't gauge the success of a galaxy-wide civilization on a timescale much less than that. It could be that you were tasked to gather data over 5 or 6 million years, and then decide a course of action, up to and including a preemptive strike, an opening salvo in an intergalactic macro-war. I smiled, more to calm myself than reassure the curator. Am I hot or cold, curator?
You have a theory that fits the evidence?
Well, almost. But if all you were supposed to do was monitor the Andromeda priors, why the secrecy?
We are being very open with each other now.
I know. But there's no reason to think you won't tinker with my memory before I leave. Thing is, if the priors were the issue, there'd be no need to be coy about it. They'd be a problem we all needed to know about. Lines and turnover civilizations included.
Secrecy might be more important than you realize, the curator said. It wouldn't do for a single culture to take unilateral action, yet that could easily have happened if knowledge of the Andromeda priors was widespread.
We could have stopped them, if it came to that.
Not necessarily.
If a civilization built a fleet and launched it towards Andromeda, there's no guarantee that the lines would have been able to neutralize it before it arrived. And even if the turnover civilization perished, the fleet would still be on its way, protected by time dilation. Nothing would have been able to catch up with it if it was moving sufficiently close to light. Fine. So there's a case for secrecy. But turnover civilizations aren't stupid. Some of them would have made their own observations of Andromeda, and seen the same evidence of prior manipulation.
The signs might have been subtle enough that it took the observational resources of the vigilance to recognize them. In any case, turnover civilizations tend to be more interested in their immediate neighbors in the galactic disk than with what might be happening 2.5 million lights away.
The curator had not denied an official interest in Andromeda. It might not mean anything, but it was at least a crumb of intelligence to take with me back to the line. It would add little to what was already known, but it would at least bolster the existing lines of argument, adding credibility to the commonality's pet theory.
Thank you for discussing these matters, I said, sensing that I had pushed about as far as was wise.
It's our pleasure. We have always had great respect for the lines, and value their confidentiality.
I will report every detail of my experiences here.
I would expect nothing less.
Above me, the ceiling heaved tremendously, like the sail of a ship catching the wind. It was as if the curator had given a titanic sigh.
But now, to business, so to speak.
I have completed the preliminary examination of the contents of your trove. I hope you didn't find the contents too disappointing.
You understate the value of your trove. There is data in it of at least partial interest to us.
I'm pleased not to have wasted your time. Feel free to copy anything that is of the slightest use to you.
And your fee for this service?
There is none.
I was given license to gift you with any data you desire as a token of the gratitude and friendship of Gentian line, in the hope of continued good relations.
That hardly seems fair, Shatterling.
It hardly seems fair to make you pay for data we know to be stale.
All data is stale. The photons reaching your eyes are stale. They tell you that you are looking at something real, but you have no information that the objects before you still exist. They may have vanished into oblivion the instant those photons took wing.
I take your point, but we still won't charge.
Then it is up to the Vigilance to make a reciprocal gesture. You have come here as an envoy, but you doubtless wouldn't turn down the chance to wander our archives.
No, I said, as cautiously as I dared, fearful that the offer might be snatched away if I clawed at it too eagerly. I wouldn't turn it down.
I have been in consultation with my fellow curators. Provided your data passes certain rudimentary validation tests, we see no difficulty in granting you a temporary access permit. You would be at liberty to consult and record data in our top-level archives. You would be able to consult, but not record, data in the secondary levels. You would be permitted to commit data to memory, but only using normal mnemonic capture modules. Third-level and deep kernel data files will not be accessible to you.
I would consider any offer to be above and beyond our expectations. What you propose is most generous, and I would be flattered to accept.
Very good, Shatterling. With your permission, the trove will remain in my gut until it has been subjected to a comprehensive examination.
That's acceptable.
Good. You may leave via my lower digestive tract. The exit is opening now.
As I watched, the fronds parted near the middle of the floor to reveal a glistening shaft that had been hidden until then.
You will not have to return to the faceplate once you have emerged from my rectum.
The curator went on. There is a waste-release spigot in my posterior armor. That's very helpful, I said.
It might be unwise to jump to conclusions, but on the assumption that your trove passes validation, there should be no obstacles to issuing you with an immediate access permit. If you have no need to return to your ship, you can begin examining the archive immediately.
Thank you, I said. You mentioned that the permit will be temporary. Can you give me an idea of when it will expire?
This is your first visit to us, Shatterling. Our relationship has got off to a good start, but we must take things gradually. Will 200 years be sufficient, just to begin with?